The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, in a time of a changing climate, researchers around the world are asking citizen scientists to use their smartphones to help monitor beach erosion and storm damage. And we'll find out why company Columbia Sportswear is currently displaying its logo on the moon. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. In a time of a changing climate, researchers around the world are asking citizen scientists to help them monitor beach erosion and storm damage. In America, to date, more than 31,000 reports from the Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf Coasts and the U.S. Virgin Islands have been filed through the MyCoast program and mobile app. MyCoast is part of a global research project called CoastSnap, which began in Australia in 2017. CoastSnap and MyCoast encourages anyone to upload their photos from their smartphones taken from cradles at fixed locations, currently in 22 countries. On beaches, as one example, photos from one location can show how shorelines change over time. To learn more, I spoke with Jess Coonan, a geologist and Hudson Estuary Resilience Specialist for New York Sea Grant. New York Sea Grant is a program of the State University of New York and Cornell University and is a MyCoast partner.
So MyCoast is an app that you can download and then upload photos of flooding, storm damage, shoreline change up to a website, a public-facing website. And when you upload photos, your photos are linked to the closest weather station, river gauge, and tidal gauge if you're on the coast, so that it's automatically kind of adding this context to the photo and placing it on a map, so then it's easily searchable later on. And what this is doing is we're building a data set to help tell the story of how New York is being impacted by storms and floods and sea level rise.
What are you observing this year that might be sort of, is this atypical for a wintertime flooding season?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of flooding this winter. And so I think that the frequency that we're seeing this happening is a little, outside of what we're used to. And a lot of that has to do with these coastal storms that are coming in and bringing storm surge and heavy rains. And so we get that combination of rain and surge and high tide. And then if it's a full moon, it can just really increase coastal flooding.
So MyCoast is actually seeking input from citizen scientists. You are looking for people to report photos of what they're observing on the river. Why is that useful to you?
Yeah, and so it's also not just for the coast. MyCoast is a statewide tool, despite the name. And really the purpose is to capture flooding and storm damage wherever it's happening. And the reason for that is because we have, you know, we have some limitations with our current tools for that help us determine, you know, where we develop and where we're building. And so photos, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. And so that's helping us capture these hyper-local flooding events. Maybe places are flooding that haven't flooded in the past. And our models might say it's not supposed to flood there, but it is. And so MyCoast is a way for community members, citizen scientists, to raise awareness of flooding in their neighborhoods and their communities.
So a component of MyCoast is what you call CoastSnap. Mm-hmm. So can you explain the difference between CoastSnap and MyCoast?
Sure, yeah. So MyCoast is kind of the larger program. And within MyCoast, we have three kind of tools. So we have FloodWatch, Photo Report, Storm Reporter, and then CoastSnap. And CoastSnap functions a little differently because these are actually posts that are in three different locations. We've got one on the Hudson River, one on the Rockaways, and one on Long Island. And these are stationary posts. It's a phone cradle that are pointed at the shoreline. And so people that are walking by, they can place their cameras in the cradle and capture the shoreline at different points in the day. Maybe the tide is high or low, or maybe it's a flooding event. And we're building a data set to show how it's changing over time. And our location on the Hudson River is especially unique because, of course, we don't have beaches here, but we do have a sustainable shoreline that the CoastNet post was looking at, so that we could monitor how it's holding up against sea level rise.
So with the CoastNet cradles that are posted in New York State, there's three. I'm imagining that requires communication or some kind of public buy-in, so people are enthusiastic about using this and actually submitting their data. But as I understand it, one of the posts is having a little bit of difficulty.
Yes, it's true. So we partnered with different public entities to install these posts. In the Hudson, we partnered with the Research Reserve, and we put the post on a fishing pier that's heavily used by the local community. And we were getting a lot of great photos, but there were some locals that were not as enthusiastic. And the post ended up disappearing. And so that was a learning experience for us. Just placing one of these anywhere, you know, you do have to get buy-in from the community in order for it to be successful.
So there are CoastNet cradles around the world, correct? This is maybe not something that you're directly working with, but this is not an effort that's limited to the Atlantic coast and the Northeast.
Exactly. The CoastNet posts are all over the world, and we know that there are a few in the U.S. We know people in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, our colleagues, that are managing their own CoastNet stations. And the idea is that it's a low-cost method to monitor the shoreline and to get this kind of steady flow of information and engage the public while we're doing it.
So let's talk about application then. Why is this data so important to municipalities, as one example?
Yeah, so a lot of some of the people that are really excited about MyCoast are meteorologists. We work with the National Weather Service, and they really appreciate seeing photos after storm events to see what the impacts were throughout the region. Emergency managers are also using this data to kind of see what's happening in real time. And then we also have modelers and researchers that kind of supplement the data that they have, maybe their own models or floodplain maps. They use these photos to kind of fill in the gaps. Just the other day, there was a researcher that noticed that there were some high water levels continuously, and he reached out to say, like, hey, has there been flooding in the region? Because that's what the gauges are telling us. And, you know, maybe there was an issue with the gauge. But yeah, we were getting photos coming in. And so we were able to confirm what he was seeing kind of out in the field. And we didn't have to send anyone out because the photos were already there.
I also imagine that this would be useful for cities and towns and villages that are looking to reclaim their waterfronts. That's something that we're seeing a lot of, particularly in this area, is you have industrial communities that were separated from their riverfronts. And there's a lot of planning and local conversations going on all over the country about how do we better utilize green and open space. And I'd imagine that this data is particularly helpful there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, we obviously don't want to develop in areas that are prone to flooding. And so these photos can help confirm, you know, what people are seeing in real time. They're taking this anecdotal information, and it's kind of documenting it and making it a little bit more of a credible source that people can easily refer to. And that's really the ultimate goal of this program, is to get planners thinking about, you know, where we should build using this fuller picture that those photos are providing of flooding that's going to be happening more frequently. It's going to start happening in places where we didn't see it before. And it already is doing that.
And so for yourself here in New York State, what's on deck for you and the MyCoast project looking ahead to the next year? What are you hoping to get off the ground?
Yeah, so we have an exciting year ahead. We're planning some educational webinars and that feature people that are using MyCoast, and we want to dig down a little deeper and get and help people understand how they can use these photos in planning. We're also going to be upping our social media game so that we can push this data back out to our users so that they can really see that what they're submitting is having an impact. And it's also a good platform to educate about flooding in general. We also have some researchers that are using the data to kind of understand, you know, gaps in our storytelling, like how do we document storm events so that they can be used for planning in the future, and how MyCoast fits into that. And then I would just say, kind of put out an open call that because we are building this data set, I think it would be great to get more researchers and educators involved in using the data for their own work.
Jess Coonan is a geologist and Hudson Estuary Resilience Specialist for New York Sea Grant. New York Sea Grant is a program of the State University of New York and Cornell University, and is a partner with citizen science research project MyCoast. More information is available at mycoast.org. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. Maryland-based company Intuitive Machines made history in February when it sent the first-ever private U.S. spacecraft to the moon. The lander, named Odysseus, nicknamed Odie, didn't have the smoothest of landings, however. The craft broke a leg, tipped over, and was shut down as the lunar night fell days later. As Odie slumbers, Intuitive Machines waits until it can be reawakened. If you look at any photos of Odie, you might notice something that seems unusual for a spacecraft. A commercial logo for Columbia, the Oregon-based sportswear company. The designer of your insulating winter jacket or rain gear lent its own Omni-Heat technology to protect Odie. The gold-colored thermal reflective material is itself inspired by NASA's technology used for the Apollo missions. Our Jody Cowan spoke with Dr. Haskell Beckham, VP of Innovation at Columbia Sportswear, to learn more.
So Omni-Heat, it was originally inspired by the NASA space blankets that they're called. If you look at the spacecraft from the old Apollo missions, you see these sometimes silver, sometimes gold, reflective foil, it looks like, wrapped around portions of these spacecraft that work to reflect heat and insulate different parts of the spacecraft from the harsh temperatures in space and on the lunar surface. Those original NASA space blankets have been adopted into consumer practice. If you go to outdoor stores, they're sold now as emergency thermal blankets. All of those materials, though, it's a continuous layer, it's a continuous film, and a continuous layer of metal, and so it doesn't breathe. Columbia's innovation back in 2010 was to take that idea, that technology that reflects heat, and integrate it onto an apparel fabric in what we call a discontinuous form. And a better way to describe that is we took that continuous sheet of metal and figured out how to print it onto a fabric in the form of little metal dots. And the space in between the metal dots, you can see the fabric. And so that's where your perspiration can go. And so the material can then breathe. And so in 2010, Columbia launched into the marketplace a technology that we call Omni-Heat. And that Omni-Heat is effectively lightweight warmth that allows us to create jackets that provide warmth at lower weight. It's highly breathable, and it's been highly successful for the company. And so that was 2010. in 2000, and I've been at the company 6.5 years, continued the development of different versions of that and better versions of that. Our next generation OmniHeat was launched into the marketplace in the fall of 2021. We decided to make that version gold because if you look at the NASA spacecraft, if you look at spacecraft in general, you see as much silver as you see gold. The original OmniHeat was silver, silver dots on a fabric. And then the next generation, the OmniHeat Infinity that we call it, which was launched in 2021, was gold dots on a fabric. And so I led the development of the next generation by understanding how much more gold dots or metallic dots we could put on the fabric and still maintain a high degree of breathability while providing additional heat reflection.
And you guys recently had a major milestone, having a version of this technology touch down on the moon with the company Intuitive Machines. I'm curious as to how the relationship with Intuitive Machines formed in the first place.
I mentioned that we launched our next generation thermally reflective heat technology in the fall of 2021. In the spring of 2021, this small space exploration company called Intuitive Machines out of Houston, Texas, reached out to us to talk to us about their upcoming moon missions. They were developing and building a lunar lander as part of the NASA Commercial Lunar Payload Services program. At the time, they're reaching out to various companies that had shared histories of innovation and exploration, and Columbia made that short list. I was on that initial call with our brand president, and we recognized immediately that this might be quite good for a couple of reasons. Number one, we were about to launch our brand new technology into the marketplace, and so there might be an opportunity for us, along with Intuitive Machines, to bring more attention to that. But secondly, when we got off the phone with Intuitive Machines folks after that initial call, I told our brand president, I said, look, I think we may be able to help these folks because the material that we are currently using, which was originally inspired by NASA and the NASA space blanket, we've evolved it and we understand how well it works. And so the second meeting with Intuitive Machines was with me and their thermal scientists and their thermal engineers. And we immediately recognized we spoke the same language in terms of insulation technology. Technical terms like solar absorptivity, solar reflectivity, thermal emissivity were terms that they were using and I was using, and I could give them hard numbers in terms of how our material behaved, and they could talk to me about what they were looking for in terms of different parts of that lander and the kinds of thermal management issues that they were facing. And so the rest is kind of history, as so they say. We formed this partnership, which really evolved into a real scientific partnership. And we started out in collaboration with Intuitive Machines by testing our existing material to see if it could withstand temperatures as high as plus 250 degrees Fahrenheit and as low as minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit. And it passed. It was durable to those temperatures. We then had to test our material in the vacuum of space because one of the things that a material or a component of a spacecraft needs to stand up to is once you put it under vacuum, you can't have volatiles coming out of the material that could then condense or deposit onto an optical surface or a thermal surface again. So we had to work with a third-party lab because we don't have capabilities in our own laboratories here in Portland, Oregon, to do that kind of testing. But we work with a laboratory that does qualify materials and components for space and for the aerospace industry, and found out that our material passed that test as well. And so we realized that we could use our material as is. And so even though we were completely prepared to modify our material after we did that initial testing, we realized we didn't have to do that. And so the material that ended up on the lander as part of the insulation package to help protect that lander, which is now on the surface of the moon from the harsh temperatures of outer space, is exactly the same material that we use in our jackets and other winter products here at Columbia Sportswear.
When we're talking about the moon, and you kind of touched on a little bit there as far as the temperature fluctuations, though, what is the natural environment of the moon like, and what conditions are we hoping to protect from?
So when we started talking to Intuitive Machines about the use of our insulation material, we talked about a number of different places on the lander in order to slot the insulation fabric. what we settled on was a panel, an external panel that was going to be facing the sun. The panel is a carbon fiber epoxy material. It's black in color. And so solar energy hitting that panel will absorb, get converted to heat, which again then transfer toward the interior of the lander. Behind that panel are the cryogenic fuel tanks. It's a combination of liquid methane, liquid oxygen tanks. And so you don't want too much heat to transfer into that because you need to maintain those temperatures of those cryogens in transit to the moon. Maintaining those cryogens is critical in order to activate a soft landing on the moon, because to slow the lander down slow enough from lunar orbit so that it soft lands on the moon, it has to be a powered descent, as they call it. And so they had to fire those engines up, which required those cryogens had to maintain those low temperatures. And so temperatures range from minus 250 Fahrenheit to plus 250 Fahrenheit, whether you're when you're in the sun. It's obviously on the high end because there's no real atmosphere on the moon. And so you're really protecting from that solar energy transfer into the lander itself. But as I indicated, a large part of the protection part for our material on the lander took place during the transit and landing portion, because once it's on the surface of the moon, you don't need the cryogens in the fuel tanks anymore.
The actual landing of the Nova C lunar lander had somewhat less than ideal results, you know, landing on its side and having kind of several complications related to flight control and other sensor issues. From your department standing, how were you guys measuring success in this mission?
You know, space is hard, and history tells us that whenever we've tried to do really hard things and, you know, sending equipment into space and landing equipment softly on the surface of the moon are among the most difficult things, one might argue, that we have ever tried to do. And history has shown that when we try to do difficult things like this, that the problem solving that occurs leads to technologies that benefit all manner of life here on Earth. And I would argue that the same thing has already happened here for us as well. We learned so much by working with the engineers at Intuitive Machines. When I talk to people and I tell them about how much science is involved in their clothing and footwear, they're often surprised. And we don't often get, I think, the recognition for being a truly innovative brand and company that I think we deserve. And so part of this mission as well was to be able to tell that story. And certainly working with a space exploration company like Intuitive Machines has given us opportunities to tell that story.
Is your job done as it relates to this mission? Are there continued plans to work with Intuitive Machines in relation to IM 1, 2, or 3, or future missions?
No, our job is not done. In fact, we are and have been working with them on a second mission, and more to come on that in the future. But I will say that we are working with them to develop new materials and better materials, again, all around insulation to help protect the lander from the harsh temperatures in space.
Other than spacecraft, are there other applications or planned applications for OmniHeat technology in space? Are we going to make a move or look to make a move to, you know, space suits or other infrastructure kinds of things?
Unclear what the future will hold for sure. I will tell you, over the past week and a half, though, since launch to touchdown and now, and all as they're pulling all the data down from the lander as it's on the surface of the moon, we've been fielding a lot of calls for interested parties in the aerospace industry and outside the aerospace industry. One of the things that I thought was fascinating is in working with this company was that the materials that they were using were legacy materials that were developed back in the day for different kinds of missions, right? There's definitely an opportunity in that space for new materials that have different property envelopes. I think, in fact, I know the Intuitive Machines engineers were pleasantly surprised at the performance of our materials that we had developed over the years. And so we look forward to looking for opportunities moving forward. Not unclear what the future will hold, though.
You guys are in a kind of unique position of having, you know, one of very few, if not the only, commercial brand on the moon, even though maybe it's a little sideways at the moment here. What does that mean for the company and for your initiatives going forward?
Well, it's certainly an exciting moment for the brand. We are proud, we're honored, humbled to be part of this mission. The Intuitive Machines collaborators and colleagues have just been fantastic to work with. It is humbling, to be honest with you. And it's kind of a surreal experience for sure. And I think people are excited about it. We're excited about it. And we notice that others have been excited for us as well. So it's been an incredible experience for sure.
I was reading about the early Apollo missions and a company like Playtex getting the opportunity to kind of get involved with creation of the spacesuits and working with NASA in these missions. Do you see parallels to that kind of collaboration with your project with Intuitive Machines?
Sure. That's an interesting analogy. I appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah, for us, this is almost like it's definitely a full circle event for us because our original OmniHeat was inspired by the NASA program, the insulation materials that were developed for those Apollo missions. We took a form of that that consumers can use and to stay comfortable here on Earth. And then we took that material to help with the commercialization of space, right? Help Intuitive Machines with their lander get back to the moon. And in the process, learned from them and the aerospace industry, took some information and brought it back to create even better products for our consumers here on Earth. And so it's almost like a ping pong effect going on here that has been really satisfying, I think, for the company. It is an opportunity for us to hopefully more people find out about Columbia and our innovative materials that we integrate into our products. And this is the really hard science basis that we build upon and putting these materials together and putting our products together. And we do a lot of field testing on Earth in the harshest environments, but the moon is definitely a new environment for us and definitely a new adventure. So it's been fantastic.
Dr. Haskell Beckham is VP of Innovation at Columbia Sportswear. Columbia's OmniHeat thermal reflective technology is being used on the private lunar lander Odysseus, developed by U.S. company Intuitive Machines. Dr. Beckham spoke with the best of our knowledge's Jody Cowan. If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1746. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.